Auburn University has this new, what they're saying is sort of like a new breed, not so much in the biological sense, but a new sort of tool in the anti-terror arsenal with these dogs that can actually hone in on a vapor trail from across the distance of, they're saying, a couple of football fields, which I gather is, that's fairly new, because previously dogs have been sort of, they're trained to hone in on a container as opposed to a trail in the air. Assuming the dogs can actually do that, how do you think this fits in? Do you think this is important? Do you think it's useful?
It is. I think it is important. Any new tool in the arsenal, as you put it, is valuable. There's only so much, though, that can be done by emphasizing a sort of, well, this is biological, but I guess a technological approach. And I think a really interesting contrast between how we pursue airport security in the United States with how the Israelis do it is it's a valuable comparison. In Israeli airports, they certainly use some high technology. They use scanners and x-rays for cars before they even get into the airport. For instance, they're exploring new technologies to detect changes in sweat and body temperature that would detect, that would highlight somebody who was nervous, who was really on edge about what they're getting ready to do. But the general thrust of Israeli airport security is to emphasize the human factor. Another comparison here is in American airports, TSA security personnel need to have an associate's degree, in other words, 2 years of college, and then they're trained to be sure. Airport security in Israel is they're all former army personnel, they're all veterans, and they are trained less in the use of technology, although that's part of their arsenal, of course, but they're much more trained in detection, interrogation, picking up on scales. Almost you could say there's sort of a parallel between the bomb-sniffing dog and how the human factor works in Israeli airports. And when people enter the airport, when they enter the parking lot, they have to have a quick chat with personnel who, as they look at their car, and they're less interested in what they find in the car than what the tenor of the conversation tells them. As they enter the airport, there are plainclothes officers walking around who are attuned to body language, and they don't even need to talk to people before they to identify them as people who need to be taken out of line and questioned further. It's the practice of setting up concentric circles of human contact with people who are highly trained to look for. It's sometimes described as profiling, but it's not really profiling because they're not simply pulling out of line people who look Arab, for instance, but they're pulling out of line people who have the telltale signs of somebody who is up to something nefarious. And then you contrast that to how we go about security in our airports and our other facilities, which there's a much greater emphasis on technology, on now all the talk courses about the full body scan imagery in airports, and then the questions about how that intrudes into privacy. All the new technology concerning baggage and checking for explosives. And they use some of that in Israeli airports, to be sure. But again, the emphasis is much more on the human factor. But then this brings us back to, well, why? If that's actually much more effective, as it's been shown to be in Israeli airports and in American airports, well, what's the context? One, there are only a couple dozen Israeli airports, and there are about 450 airports in the United States that are staffed by TSA security. And then if we're not just talking about airports, but we're talking about any sort of public gathering, as in the case last April with the Boston Marathon bombing, for instance, we're talking about every public sporting event. We're talking about every transportation venue. We're talking about mass transit. We are talking about every single government office, building, facility, all the way down to the local level. And And that is an incredible number of targets that have to be secured or somehow hardened to become more impervious to penetration or attack by terrorists. And in the United States, it's always been our want to seek a technological solution rather than a solution that in some ways is easier, more common sense, but requires more perhaps training or expertise. Technology seems to be our go-to response.
Is that because there are people who make money from technology? I mean, why do you think that is? Is it a cultural thing?
Well, I think it's, as I said, it's the scale of the problem, and that demands, I mean, the TSA has 55,000 employees, and there's a limit, both in terms of the human capital available and the resources that would have to be invested. There's a limit to the size of a professional body you could have that would be trained, for instance, the way that Israeli airport security is trained. I don't know. I think it is. It's historical. It's cultural. Our fascination with technology, our expectation that technology, while it presents problems, always we assume can always provide the solution as well.
So given the scale of the problem here in the United States, I mean, it sort of makes more sense that this new breed of dog would sort of fit a niche here as opposed to in Israel. It sort of makes more sense. You think that's true?
Well, as long as it's a all of the above solution, that's important. Because, I mean, if you're really thinking about anti-terrorism or counterterrorism, it takes place in about at least four different ways. One is neutralizing enemy leaders, killing or capturing them. Another is interdicting funds, material resources, human resources, safe houses, passive support. One then is dealing with terrorist acts after the fact. How are they investigated? How are they caught? How are they prosecuted? And then if you're talking about how do you harden targets, then it is, you don't want to put all the eggs in one basket because that's such a resource intensive way of dealing with the terrorist threat, because then you can keep asking, well, okay, we've made this target secure. Well, then you look around and you see how many other targets are vulnerable. And that's unfortunately one of the things that makes terror a powerful tactic, particularly for those who are otherwise so weak, is that they can choose the time and the place of the attack. And the attack is not chosen to conquer a piece of territory, to disable an enemy military, so on and so forth. It's to grab attention by going after symbolic targets. And those exist everywhere. So hardening of targets, securing targets can only be so much of the portfolio of countering terror as a threat.
Okay. So for hardening, even though it's definitely an incomplete strategy, but for hardening those large crowd type of targets, mm-hmm. airports, train stations, you know, ball games, whatever it may be, these dogs, they seem like it would be, assuming they can do what they're billed, that seems like one useful part of a larger picture?
Sure. It certainly would be. Again, as long as all the eggs aren't put in one basket. Another valuable tool that's been time and time again has found to be valuable is simply having uniformed officers of quite visible. And this is something that, you know, that works, you know, that criminologists have long known. One way to combat crime, to suppress crime, is to simply have law enforcement officers visible and aware. Another thing, of course, is to make sure that they have good relationships with the local community. But certainly a more highly attuned canine bomb sniffer could certainly be a valuable tool. I assume these are pretty resource-intensive dogs, both in terms of the project that produces them and the cost of the individual dog, plus the handlers and whatnot. But as long as it's part of an arsenal, and it's not treated as in and of itself an end-all, be-all to the threat, then it certainly could be valuable.
Okay, now this is not really part of my story, but I can't help but ask. Do you think, now you can answer this if you want, for the population in general and separately for our government agencies, our security apparatus, are we too scared of something that's fairly unlikely?
Oh, it's absolutely. And it's an unpopular thing to say that, because terrorism has achieved such a grip on us today. And, you know, you can pick your statistic. People, you know, an American is far more likely to die in a lightning strike, choking to death on a ham sandwich, which are sort of jokey responses. But Americans are, far, far more likely to die from something preventable, like lung cancer that you get because of smoking, or heart disease, or, you know, automobile fatality. But it comes down to risk analysis and the psychological dimension of it. And a good way to illustrate that is that if you ask people what's safer, or what do they feel safer doing, traveling by car or traveling by plane, and most people are convinced that they are far safer to when they travel in their own car. Partially it's that they, you know, it's a sense of control that they feel that they have. But of course, it's also how fatalities are reported. We, you know, getting into the car and risking life and limb every day is just sort of part of the cost of living in the modern world, particularly in one that characterized by urban sprawl and private commuting as it is in the States. But the fatalities per mile traveled for air travel are far, far lower. It's low risk, high cost. When a plane goes down, one or two people don't die, as in the case of an auto fatality. It's hundreds, perhaps. And that grabs our attention. And I think it's partially because we're all aware somewhere, perhaps in that reptilian part of our brain, that there's something unnatural about getting in a plane and being suspended 25,000 feet above the earth. But it's our sense of it's the psychological dimension of risk analysis. And of course, those who commit terror acts, that's the calculus of it. That is part of the calculation, not to achieve a direct military victory, because they don't have the resources to do that, but to intimidate, to terrorize, to make personal the loss. You see this in cinema and fiction and media representations of terrorism. Their terror acts are often presented in a way so that people who were hundreds, thousands of miles away from where the attack occurred can imagine themselves in the story. They can place themselves, they can insert themselves into the story. And like with the Boston Marathon, it wasn't even that it was runners who were killed or injured. It was simply people on the sidewalk. And again, not to turn this into something amusing, but people look up and they say, "I was on a sidewalk today." And the idea being that terrorists could strike anywhere at any time, and so the number of casualties in the end are really not terribly important or significant. It's the sense of fear and how that perturbs, how that transforms our sense of personal security in a way that we've grown used to it from all sorts of other threats. People knew the health cost of eating fast food. If they really understood it in really visceral terms, well, they probably wouldn't eat the stuff. But they just accepted it as part of how we live, in a way that we still don't accept terrorism as a normal part of life. At least in the United States, we don't.
Right. In Israel?
Yeah, in other places, obviously, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, it has obviously, it's twisted daily life. It's where people live, how they commute, barriers erected to keep populations apart, pervasive security, which has, you know, in some places still not really made enough of a dent in the number of acts. But for Americans, the danger is relatively minor. You know, never mind then that we are convinced that the terrorist threat to us is still from beyond our shores. It's from the alien other. It's from the Arab or the Muslim who should look like they are a terrorist. Never mind that, except for 9/11, if you take that out of the equation, in the last several decades, there are far more deaths from deaths of Americans from terror acts carried out by Americans against them who were motivated by causes and ideologies and beliefs that were intrinsically American. The terror threat in the United States is as much or greater coming from domestic sources than it is from foreign sources. So which is also a part of how media entertainment has twisted our sense of risk evaluation in terms of the origins of terrorism in the United States.
Now, speaking of media and perception, so it just occurs to me to ask this. While you were talking, I had this thought. So CNN did this story on these vapor wake dogs, new breed of dogs. I'm going to do a little story. It's probably going to be local or regional. It's not going to be national. Okay. But, okay, it's publicity. It's something. Does the reporting of this potential new technology, does that help in the larger problem because it sort of makes people feel a little safer?
I don't know. That's a good question. It might make people a bit safer. I think the size of the enormity of the threat and the way it's been hardwired into all aspects of our daily life and not just our media consumption, but you know, entertainment and our sort of daily rhetoric we employ, that the terror threat has become so omnipresent that I think the it needs to be contested on a far more sort of fundamental basis. Why are we so afraid of this? Why do we? Well, it's almost like our affinity for horror movies, and not just horror movies, but the worst sort of torture porn horror movie. We seek it out. But also the way that we characterize the terror threat is contributes significantly to the problem. If you look at so much media, entertainment, how we address the threat of terrorism, we spend very little of our time actually looking at the motivations of those who might want to carry out these acts. Part of the danger, of course, is that when you explain, some people see that as a justification. But it's also our desire to desire to accuse those who carry out terrorism as crazy. Because it doesn't seem to make sense to us, we assume that they are insane, and in so doing, we tell ourselves that there's no point to even try to figure out why they do it, and therefore we emphasize in every way, shape possible our own psychological response to it. So I don't know if we can make ourselves feel safer by only treating that side of the equation.
Dr. Lowe, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk to you.